Morning, everyone.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Looks like we have everyone here. This is June 24, 2020, the Minnesota Court of Appeals. There are three cases on the calendar today, and this is our third case. I'll have the clerk or the marshal call the matter. I think you're on mute. Here we go.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Bratfield, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
All right, just a few things before we begin, everyone. Please mute your microphone if you are not speaking. We do get some feedback if the microphones are not muted. The marshal will show a running clock of your time. Please pay attention to the time that is allotted. Before you begin your argument, please identify yourself and your client as well. Each party will have 15 minutes for oral argument, and the appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. And with that, counsel, you may begin.
Thank you.
I'll just call the case. This is A19-1943, Matthew William Edwards versus State of Minnesota.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Chelsea Willett, and I represent appellant Matthew Edwards. The main issue before this court is whether the record establishes a lack of a warrant and a lack of an exception to the warrant requirement, thereby invalidating appellant's conviction for test refusal. Appellant was convicted of test refusal for refusing warrantless demands for his blood and urine in 2011. In 2019, appellant filed a post-conviction petition asking the district court to vacate his conviction for test refusal following the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Johnson, which held that the Birchfield rule applied retroactively to final convictions on collateral review. The Birchfield rule invalidated test refusal convictions for those convicted of refusing a warrantless blood or urine test. In its response, the state failed to specify any exception to the warrant requirement besides the former per se exigency of natural dissipation of alcohol in the bloodstream, which was invalidated by McNeely. The district court agreed with the state and denied the petition because it held that the per se exigency of dissipation of alcohol in the blood was valid at the time of the offense and that the holding in McNeely was not retroactive. This court recently held the opposite in Hagerman, which held that the ruling in McNeely invalidating the per se exigency was substantive in the context of test refusal cases, which are challenged under the Birchfield rule, and that McNeely does apply retroactively. As the state only relied upon the per se exigency invalidated by McNeely, and it failed to specify any other exception, we are asking that this court, consistent with Hagerman, reverse the district court's order and find that appellant's unconstitutional conviction should be vacated.
Counsel, say we agree with you and that Hagerman controls at least the determination of whether Mr. Edwards' conviction should be vacated, so the retroactivity of McNeely. Is it appropriate for this court, different from Hagerman, to remand in this case because Mr. Edwards has not, and the state have not, the district court has not made the necessary findings in an evidentiary hearing?
We did not have an evidentiary hearing because the only exigency that the state raised was the single factor exigency, and that's the only one that was relied upon. Mr. Edwards, or appellant here, did not request an evidentiary hearing simply because we were stating that on the record there was no warrant, there was no apparent exception to the warrant requirement, which is very similar to the appellant in Hagerman. The state in that case also did not specify any other exception besides the single factor exigency, and the court.
And I appreciate that, counsel, but it is true that Hagerman came down while this case was pending. In fact, after the briefing on appeal. So I'm just trying to understand whether we really treat this the same way as the petitioner appellant in Hagerman, or whether in this situation there should be a remand for an evidentiary hearing.
Our position is that the state had the opportunity to argue other exigencies or other exceptions to the warrant requirement. It failed to do so. And like the state in Hagerman, the state should not have another opportunity or another bite at the apple, as it were, to argue another exigency or another exception when it already had that opportunity in district court to raise that issue. And certainly at that point, an evidentiary hearing could have been made. What the court found was that that exigency that the state relied upon, the court district court found was valid. It wasn't until after that time that this court has said that no, that's no longer a valid exception. But the fact remains that the state did have an opportunity to make an argument regarding other exceptions or another exigency or exception to the warrant requirement. So we are still asking for this court to reverse the conviction, because based off of what the district court had in front of it and what the state argued at the time, that single factor exigency is no longer valid. Okay. I'm sorry, I don't hear if you're muted, I think.
I didn't say anything. So I listened to your answer and you can go right ahead, counsel.
Yep. Okay, thank you. And I know that there was an issue raised in the briefing regarding the timeliness. The district court really didn't raise, or I'm sorry, the district court did not make a ruling on that issue. So what I would say with regards to that is just that we did file the petition within 2 years of the exception to this, which was the Johnson case. We found was the exception to the time bar in this case, because we pointed to the new interpretation of law, which was Birchfield. We pointed to the Johnson case, which is what made the Birchfield rule retroactive, and appellant filed his petition within 2 years of the Johnson decision. And so we would just say for the record that this was a timely petition. And if this court is concerned about the timeliness, because the district court didn't address that issue and there's no error to review or correct here, at most, this case could be remanded for ruling on the timeliness issue. The petitioner has satisfied the exception with regards to the timeliness and with regards to the warrantless demands for the blood and urine. We've shown that there was no warrant in this case. The state has failed to point to any exigent circumstance or any exception to the warrant requirement, which would make conviction potentially valid and could have been argued at district court. The state failed to do so, and so we are asking that this court, like in Hagerman, reverse the conviction here and Mr. Edwards or appellant's unconstitutional conviction should be vacated. If there are no other questions, I feel like I've had everything that I need to at this point, and I could reserve any further argument for rebuttal.
Well, let me ask you a little bit more then about the timeliness question. I was intrigued by your answer that perhaps this is an issue that should go back on remand. So it sounds like you think there might be a need to have a district court analyze the timeliness of the petition.
Simply because this is an error correcting court, and I understand that that issue was raised by the state, and I presume that that will be raised later on in this argument today. And based off of what we've presented to the court, we believe that this is a timely petition, that there is no need for a remand, but to the extent that this court is concerned about the timeliness issue, then at most there should be a remand with instructions for the district court to analyze the timeliness issue.
Right. And I guess I'm trying to understand what the interpretation is of the clause. I've read the state's brief, so I know what their interpretation is of the clause 3 and subdivision 4 of our post-conviction review statute. But what is your interpretation? So does that exception work 2 years from the both the latest of both of those events, the interpretation of a federal or state constitution or statutory law and retroactivity? Is that how you would argue it?
Correct. Yes. Once the petitioner is able to establish that there is a new rule of law and that rule applies retroactively, then the 2 years starts running from the date that it's applied retroactively, which in this case was the date that the Johnson case came out. And appellant's petition was filed well in advance of 2 years from when the Johnson decision came out. He did assert, of course, as I said, the new interpretation of law, and he established that it was retroactive, and he filed within 2 years of that retroactivity date.
All right, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Anything else from the panel today? All right, thank you, Ms. Willett. Mr. Kennedy, just wait one moment while we reset the clock. I think we need 15 minutes on the clock. All right, Mr. Kennedy, I see you're muted. Go ahead, sir.
May it please the court. My name is George Kennedy, and I appear on behalf of respondent, the state of Minnesota. I'd like to address the retroactivity issue briefly before focusing on the timeliness of the petition. Regarding retroactivity, I understand that this court is bound by the published opinion in Hagerman. While I disagree with that decision, my understanding is that a petition for review is going to be filed. I'll rely on my brief, specifically pages 14 to 21. I'm happy to answer any questions on that issue, but I do want to focus on the timeliness issue. Turning to the time bar.
So, counsel, just to clarify, you don't see any distinguishing fact of either the record or the law in this case with regard to Hagerman? I mean, I understand that you respectfully disagree with the ruling, but you've already recognized that, of course, we do follow the published decisions of this court, unless they are distinguishable. So it sounds like you're not making that argument. I didn't see a basis for distinguishing it, so.
I understand that Hagerman says the McNeely rule as applied to test refusal is retroactive. That's factually the same situation here. So, like I said, I disagree with that decision, and I'll rely on my written submission for that. Turning to the time bar, the state Supreme Court in Prentice Jackson and Tyree Jackson has already said that the 2 year time frame for filing a post-conviction petition starts when the new rule is announced instead of when the new rule is recognized as being retroactive. I apologize for not including those in my principal brief. I came across those as I was researching a similar issue for a different case. My research in this briefing focused on Subdivision 4, paren B3. If I had looked at 4C, I would have come across those sooner. But under those two cases and 590.01 Subdivision 4B3, the appellate court does not need to decide that a new rule is retroactive before the claim is ripe. And I think it's easiest to talk about these issues in terms of ripeness instead of when the petition becomes time barred. The appellant's interpretation is that you need a retroactivity determination before the claim can be filed. And that leads to a ridiculous result. Even looking at Johnson v. State, the case that appellant points to for the retroactivity determination, there were two petitions in that file. One of them was a 2010 pre-McNeely conviction, and the other one was a 2014 conviction. I believe that the 2014 petition, or the petition on the 2014 case was filed within 2 years of that conviction becoming final. So there was no 4B3 analysis required. That case fell under the ordinary post-conviction statute, 4A. The 2010 conviction, on the other hand, if appellant is correct, wasn't ripe until Johnson itself was decided. And I think that that shows that there is an issue, a significant issue, with that that interpretation of the statute. We also have an interest in finality, a social interest in having decisions on criminal cases being final. We want to deal with any issues sooner than later to reduce the chances of any memory or witness issues. So creating a situation where some petitioners will be able to file right away and other petitioners will not defeats the purpose of finality. The decisions in Prentice Jackson and Tyree Jackson saying that a petition has to be filed within 2 years of when the new rule is announced is consistent with that. I'll acknowledge that it creates a race to the courthouse, but it means that we're dealing with post-conviction petitions sooner rather than later. We're getting vigorous litigation to determine these issues. It's up to the individual petitioner to establish that the new rule has retroactive effect. It's not something where the appellate courts need to do that before a claim can be filed. I think if we also look at Dodd, which is the federal case that I've cited, that corroborates this interpretation. In that case, there is a general rule, which is the first subdivision, the date that a judgment of conviction becomes final, is when the post-conviction or the habeas claims become ripe. But then there are exceptions, much like 590.01 subdivision 4. There's a general rule, and then there are exceptions. This exception, like the exception dealt with in Dodd, has one date when a claim becomes ripe for post-conviction review, and that date is when the new rule is announced, not sometime down the road when an appellate court decides that the new rule is retroactive. If there aren't any other questions, I believe that this is a legal determination that this court can make. I don't think that a remand is necessary to affirm on alternative grounds, specifically that the post-conviction petition was time-barred.
So, counsel, I'd like to ask you about that. You heard the appellant's counsel say that perhaps a remand hearing would be necessary to explore the timeliness issue. That obviously wasn't decided by the district court here. So your position is no, we do not need to remand on that?
I don't think it's necessary. I took a look at the appellate rules. I'm not able to file a cross appeal on that issue. I can only appeal a post-conviction decision if post-conviction relief is granted. Otherwise, I would have considered the cross appeal. This is a way that I can preserve that issue. And again, I think it's a legal determination that this court can make based on the petition itself and the record of this case.
I guess I'm missing something from your argument. So if we were to remand the issue, you could still continue to make the argument that you just made. You're not losing an issue for review, right? It would just potentially involve another appeal, say we remanded and you failed to prevail below on timeliness.
I agree with that as an alternative, Your Honor.
Okay. And then I wanted to ask you about remand for a different reason. So, you know, this is a situation where the Fagan case was released, 5 days before the district court's decision? And so not referenced by the district court, and that's not a surprise. That certainly happens. Isn't it then appropriate for us to remand for applicant, because the district court treated the burden of proof differently from the ruling in Fagan. So shouldn't we remand for that reason as well?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
So it sounds like on balance, you are looking for a remand, at least if there's going to be further analysis of the initial issue in the case.
Yes, if the court isn't willing to decide the timeliness issue on appeal, then I think a remand is necessary.
Yeah, to give the primary relief, assuming we, so we could theoretically remand both. Isn't that right? Both the timeliness issue as well as the merits of the petition.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Any further comments on that, counsel? Suggestions for
helping? I have nothing further, Your Honor. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Anything else from the panel? All right. Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. One moment, Ms. Willett, while we get the, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Good.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
All right, counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just quickly, with regards to the timeliness issue, the state brings up the Dodd case, which was a U.S. Supreme Court case that interpreted a federal statute, which was a federal habeas statute, which is, I would just like to point out, is very different from the Minnesota statute here. The Minnesota legislature said that the claim had to be filed within 2 years of when a petitioner should have known an appellate court recognized a new rule, and that that rule was established that that rule retroactively applied to petitioner. That's very different from the language that is in the statute that was analyzed by Dodd. With regards to the Jackson cases, those cases were not in the information that, in the brief that I received rather, but I did have an opportunity to review the Jackson cases. And in those cases, they're also very different from appellant's case because those were pro se litigants, those were pro se petitioners. They did not argue any exception applied. The exception was applied judicially as they analyzed the petition. And the pro se petitioners also did not argue retroactivity. So in those cases, all the court could do was to take the date that the law that the petitioners raised or brought up to the court, all they could do was take that date and see whether that was within 2 years of their filing. But the petitioners never had a chance to litigate the retroactivity of that, which is very different here. Here we have an appellant who not only was able to point to a new interpretation of law, but was also able to point to a case which made that new interpretation of law retroactively applicable. And this type of issue was actually discussed recently in a U.S. Supreme Court case, Ramos v. Louisiana. And in Ramos, the court noted that retroactivity test is very difficult to satisfy. It asserted that retroactivity is typically decided in future cases following a new rule of law or a new interpretation of law. And that's to provide the court the benefit of adversarial testing through briefing by litigants and argument. And then it's decided whether or not that new rule is retroactive. And that's what we have here. We have a situation where the Birchfield rule was laid out as a new rule of law, new statutory interpretation. And then we have a litigant, Mr. Johnson, who followed that all the way to the Supreme Court, which ultimately ruled it was retroactive. What the state is saying is that essentially we would have to file right after Birchfield rule was established and be denied. And certainly someone has to litigate that, but for judicial economy and efficiency, it doesn't make any sense to file many petitions arguing the same thing. What we do is we have one litigant and we follow that all the way to the Supreme Court and hopefully get that retroactivity ruling. But before then, when we know that we have that argument already in the works, it doesn't make any sense for petitioners to continue filing petitions knowing that they would be denied because that new rule had yet to be deemed retroactive. And that's the situation we have here. Appellant waited until that case came down, ruling on the retroactivity issue, then filed the petition asking for the court to provide him relief based off of the new interpretation of law. And
so, counsel, I just want to follow up quickly. I realize that some of these issues have really changed dramatically, you know, with our decision in Hagerman, and I'm not suggesting that you both didn't attempt to brief it as thoroughly as possible, but then Hagerman came down, which kind of shifted our focus. So on the timeliness issue, you know, we do have the supplemental authorities that the state has suggested should control our view of how timeliness works and how that exception works under the Minnesota post-conviction statute. What would you suggest we look at if it's not the Jackson cases as cited by the state? Did you find other authorities that you think that guide our analysis on how that extension or exception works?
We're really just looking at the plain language of the statute, yeah. But I would also just state that this is an error correcting court. And as I stated in the beginning, if this court is concerned about the timeliness of the petition, then we would ask in that case for a remand for the district court to make a ruling on the timeliness of that. And then we can further litigate that at that point.
And I think the state's position is just that it's a question of law, so that it, unlike the underlying issue vacating the conviction, which I appreciate you think is a question of law at this point, because so little remains to be developed, but normally that vacature would involve an evidentiary hearing as to the prongs that have been articulated in Fagan. So different from that, we have a question about the extension to the 2-year time limit on the post-conviction petition. There isn't a fact issue there, is it? It is really a question of law, I think. Do you agree?
The facts here are clear that we filed the petition following the Johnson case, and that was not within 2 years of Birchfield.
You stated that better than I did. So the only facts are undisputed with regard to timeliness. Isn't that right?
There are no factual disputes, right. But we would still ask for a remand in that case to make arguments to the district court regarding the timeliness. And like I said, we can litigate that further beyond that point.
Thank you.
Anything else from the panel today? All right, counsel, thank you very much. I appreciate your patience and cooperation with this WebEx argument today. And the matter was well briefed and argued. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an order and an opinion in due course.